Welcome to another edition of the Exponential Podcast. I'm Todd Wilson, Director of Exponential. We're thrilled you're taking advantage of this free resource that was recorded at the Exponential Conference. It's part of a library of hundreds of hours of free training. In our mission to equip church planting leaders, we seek to distribute as many free resources as possible. Visit exponential.org to learn more and to check out the programming for the upcoming Exponential Conference.
All right, well, just so we can save a little time, a little brimstone conversation today. How did they frame that in the, I didn't get a chance to look.
Culture and cultural engagement in something
crazy world.
So is that why you guys felt like you wanted to spend the time in this? Is just more of the issues related to?
I saw your picture and I was like, I have to hear this.
It's because you, Tangible Kingdom and...
So how many of you actually read some of our stuff, Tangible Kingdom? Anybody read Anne? Any flesh readers? Okay. So Brimstone was, if you followed my writings, we were church planters, both in Portland and Denver. And most of my friends growing up were always outside the church, so I feel like that was my training ground on a lot of the issues related to how you actually engage people that would not normally come to a church. And so both of our churches started very high degree of evangelism on both of those. And looking down at the people that were coming to faith, these were not people that, they verbally would have said we would never go to a church, and somehow something began to happen around our family and our lives where just stuff happened. And then we, in both settings, we created church after the house was full, so to speak. And so in both settings, we really teach planting missionary communities and then learning how to structure that in the congregation later. So most of the stuff that you would catch at Expo would be a more traditional launch strategy where, you try to do a really good church service and then you try to get your people to live as missionaries and engage people. But I think both can work. I think the stats really are leaning more towards missionary life is a better way to go than starting church services, especially if you want to reach what we call, call it M2, M3. Have you guys ever heard Alan Hirsch speak about cultural distance? It's kind of a missionary concept, which is a good way to start, but, and you guys have probably seen me do this, that'll be the percentage of people in church in America in about 10 years. If we just keep doing church the way we're doing it and whatever. So big question mark is how do you engage the mission field, specifically when the mission field already sort of kind of knows about the story of Jesus, they just don't want to be a Christian. Okay, so when you're in a culture that, because I very rarely meet somebody that doesn't believe that Jesus was a person, a very important person, but they just literally have an aversion to the Christian, the evangelical Christian church. Okay? And obviously, I think it's probably the biggest reason is that issue of judgmentalism that we're now putting out there. So, if you want to keep doing church, that idea of just doing a church service on Sunday and trying to get your people to be good neighbors, I don't think it's going to get the job done. That's just my personal take on that. Good friends, Jay Papik, Dave Runyon, are my accountability guys who wrote The Art of Neighboring. And we talk all the time just about, they're not even sure they believe in their stuff. Because and it's not so much they don't believe that we should learn how to neighbor. They're just realizing as they go church to church that the Christians in churches, they don't even know the names of their neighbors. And if they try to go get the names, they don't even know how to act to become a friend of those people. So I just feel like our paradigm of discipleship over the last 40 years has literally trained people away from knowing how to relate with the normal people, the people that don't share our sexual orientation or our belief system or our religious viewpoint or our political persuasion. So we're really going to talk about, how do we engage that? Again, this idea of, local Sunday church, it's going to be effective for what we call M0s. These are missionary distances, we call them. So if you go on a mission field, if I were to go to Kenya, I would be going, okay, what are the barriers to the gospel for me as a white
evangelical in America. What do you know? I probably have a language barrier. I have a lot of cultural barriers. I have a skin color. I mean, so in some contexts, like if we were to go to Iraq and try to start a church movement, we'd actually probably say we have an M5 situation. We have lots of significant barriers to them getting the gospel. Local Sunday church, primarily exposed, primarily a white-led, white participant, you know, type of a conference. So even if we went inner city, if we went in a multi-ethnic area, you're going to at least be an M2. But most Christians never know how to engage past M0. M0 means I know how to reach, well, or they, we think that we know how to reach people that are just exactly like us. So if we're in a white suburb, then we can be pretty decent with white suburban people as long as they share our, they have kids like we have kids and they have sex like we have sex. And does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So what I really want to talk through is how to at least get to M2. I don't think most of us will get here. Sort of missiologically, the gospel still generally travels the fastest in homogeneous type of, so you really are going to reach who you are mostly. But I'm going to call M2 at least lost people. Okay? So if we're planting churches, this is a planting conference. If we're really going to plant a church, it's going to reach lost people. And I think we've got to rethink some of the ways we do that. So before we get going any further, just so I can make sure I kind of tailor this to you guys, I mean, we really are small enough. We can go any direction you want. But what are the primary tensions you're feeling as a leader or just as a person in engaging culture, specifically lost people? Just throw it out there. Let's might as well be honest in this environment.
Tensions you're feeling.
How to even find places to connect with.
Okay.
Because we're so much in our Christian culture.
Okay. How to just connect. Good. What else?
Getting past the basics, assumption that they have that I already hate them and reject them.
Yeah.
How do you begin to penetrate that?
That's a huge one, right? So how many, when you get asked what you do, how many of you don't want to tell them? Because that's a barrier now, right? So if you say I'm a pastor, iffy. If you say you're planting a church, definite, like, oh, so that's why you're even talking to me. Okay, so it's the perceived assumptions about what we're on about, okay? What other tensions do you feel?
There is a time aspect that the frenetic pace of the American culture now with families and stuff, there's just no time for cultural engagement or even the aspects in which they might be in the culture through sports and through school and stuff like that. It's not. Yep. They don't view it as that. That's just where they go. They don't want to disrupt it.
Yep. That's good.
But maybe couples, a particular couple in my ministry, we talked about it and it's just, we decided we're just not interested.
Yep.
And friendly, you do your thing, we'll do our thing, all good.
Yep. Okay.
But that's common.
Those of you who came in late, we're talking about the tensions that we really feel, either personally or trying to move our church people to engage the truly lost world that we're in. So, said time constraints, all that stuff. What else?
From the church perspective toward the community or the community toward the church?
Either way, just why are we not making redemptive relationships with the people to where they're interested in us and they would call us their friend.
We live in a highly religious culture. We live in Utah, and a lot of people just think, I'm good, I got it figured out, and they aren't interested in what we're trying to sell them, I guess.
Okay. Cool.
Getting members to get over the cultural barriers and out of comfort zone. In the South, in Durham, North Carolina, where I am, the opportunity is moving from inviting people to an event to engaging the culture. So the tension is, I've been hearing for all my life to be a good Christian, I need to go to church and stay away from lost people. Now you're telling me the opposite.
Yeah.
You're telling me to leave the church and become friends with people who need Christ.
Yeah. So we have had a theological, I grew up in a holiness movement, Nazarene deal. So you know, my parents were actually not legalists. They were actually really great. But I do remember no movie theater, no rolling
I had to dump my Billy Idol CDs in college, you know. Everybody got in a fight over U2 not being a Christian, so I had to dump those. I mean, so that's the world I came from. But yeah, I mean, I learned holiness is coming away from the world. And now we're actually saying, okay, we're now mission field, so missiologically, we've got to think differently. That's why if you have read Flesh, I redefine, is that me? So
rude. You found your bag.
Funny story, I think I put it, it might have been in Brimstone, where I was about to throw a paper cup out the window at somebody that was texting. So angry about the whole texting thing, that I literally was going to roll down my window and throw like a paper cup. And then a text came in, so I was like, I think I put that story in there just about the issue of judgment for all of us. Anyway, okay, so good backdrop for that. What I want to do is I'm going to go back to some of the Flesh material. If you haven't read Flesh, Flesh was the best thing I could write on evangelism. That's what I've always wanted to write my whole life. If you've not read that yet, I would grab that. I wrote that as an evangelistic training for churches without telling it, so I'm trying to sneak attack for your people. A new way of life that I think will help them to engage the culture. Brimstone, I would just call it Flesh Part 2. There's one chapter in the Flesh book called Friend of Sinners, where we're dealing with that real issue, okay, well, what if our neighbors really are gay? How do you become a friend in that scenario? In Denver, Colorado, everybody's smoking dope. So what if your neighbors are rolling dudes out all day long and it's wafting over the playset that your kids are on in the back, you know? So Brimstone, I wrote just a whole book just on that one topic of non-judgmental holiness. Okay, so you can see they both kind of go together, but when people are reading Flesh, they kept going, give me more on that friend of like, so I see the issue of why we're not seeing lost people come to Jesus primarily based on that single issue. We do not know how to be friends with sinners. Okay, so I'm going to take you back to the Flesh grid. And Flesh gives what I call the way of Jesus. And for me, I define, in our church, we defined discipleship as learning to live your human life the way Jesus lived his. That's our definition of a disciple. Discipleship was always what? Learn some scripture, go to church, stop doing the big sins, right? I actually think, you know, this is Paul, if you want to throw down some notes. You'll hear it in Paul's language. He'll go, I've been crucified with Christ, so it's no longer I who live, it's Christ who is a living. You know, Jesus lives my life. So when I'm training evangelism, I go, okay, if you let Jesus live your life, would he live it differently than you do? And most people go, oh yeah, I'm pretty sure it'd be way different, okay? So if you reframe discipleship, in other words, if you go, okay, how do I move the people in our church to engage culture? I think you should actually start with a redefinition of what a disciple is. If you try to get them to be evangelistic, they're not going to be, because evangelism, they know in their minds, doesn't work. So why are you asking me to do this again, Pastor? I'm not going to go door to door. My neighbors don't like me. I don't even like them. So I would say whenever you're trying to move your church or people evangelistically, don't ever put it in an evangelistic lens. Put it in a spiritual formation lens. So say, we're doing this because we want to let Jesus be forming us. Remember, that's what Paul said at the end of that same book, Galatians. He said, I'm going to stay and remain with you. So he's speaking as a spiritual leader. Like, this is really the job of pastoring. I'm going to stay with you until Christ be formed in you. And we have always said, then formation is learning concepts about Jesus. I think Paul's going, until the way Jesus lived in the neighborhood is the way you live. Okay, so does that make sense?
Yes.
So create a spiritual formation grid. If you say, are you guys bored with your spiritual walk? Just doing devotions and going to church? Most people go, and so this is why we're doing this, guys, because we want to see the power of God again in our neighborhood. We want you to see Jesus actually do something. So when you say it like that, usually most Christians will go, okay, I'm at least open to reconsidering. Okay, Colossians says it's Christ in us, it's the hope of glory.
1 John 2:7 says, these are for the stubborn people. If anybody claims to be in him, so if you claim to be a Jesus follower, you must walk as Jesus walked. Not that you know what Jesus knew, you must walk as Jesus walked. As the Father has sent me, I now send you. So you have to go, okay, then how did the Father send Jesus? So this became the flesh grid, the sending way of Jesus. So we start with incarnation. Okay? Sorry, I'm such a terrible whiteboard writer. Incarnation. That incarnation, and I'll walk you through again, leads to a reputation with people. So the street cred begins to change. Okay, so what people, so that was one of the questions. How do we change the persona of what people think this is? When I define evangelism, my primary gift is evangelism. It may be my only gift. In hundreds of people, friends that have come to faith, just in our home, I've never went at somebody evangelistically. They've always come towards me. So I always say evangelism is more like walking backwards as people come towards you. So, you know, be ready to give a defense. Be ready, right? Not go at them with your defense. Not be an adversary and put a finger in their chest. But when they're coming at you, so that's the assumption in the New Testament. They're coming at you. Okay? So evangelism for me is not telling people something they don't know. It's changing the assumptions about what they think it is. And the way that you begin to change assumptions is you have to incarnate. So if I go, why did Jesus come to earth? We would go, well, he came to die for sins, for sure. Probably the most important reason, right? If he doesn't die for sins, we're all completely done, right? But if I say, could there be another reason why he came? A lot of people, even pastors, go, I'm not sure. What I mean, I think the other main reason, and I think it was just as important to Jesus, was that he would model a way of humanity that would change the hearts of people. So then when we become a follower, we just walk his way, and it should have the same impact. So people came at Jesus. He never had to go after people, right?
No.
They're either coming at him personally or they're bringing people to him. Mm-hmm. So what would it look like if we disciple that in our people so they would know or become the type of people that people want to go to? Well, the issue of reputation then becomes very important. There's things that Jesus did that got a favorable reputation with the people. I'll just highlight a few of those. I don't want to spend too much time because you guys can read that. I think it's a pretty easy read. By the way, at the end of every chapter, there's a think, feel, and do paradigm. It's designed to actually train your people for you. So if you want to actually move this way, I'd say get small groups reading it or reading groups reading it. Most of our Tangible Kingdom Primer, which is our little kind of missional engagement kind of 201, I would use flesh as a filter before you move people into that, because that's an actual experience in community to engage. But it's a little bit hard if you don't let people process the paradigm first. So I would use flesh as the mental sort of new lens to see this through, and then the people that seem to like what they read in flesh, then you can actually move them forward into a training capacity. So I'll share a little bit more about that, but reputation then leads to a conversation. In the conversation, or in the relationship around that, you will have a confrontation of sin. So we always wonder, how do we get the culture to know that they need Jesus, right? Well, evangelical evangelism has been based on getting at that sucker as fast as we possibly can. So we are going to put the finger in the chest of the culture. We are going to get on CNN and condemn the practice of yoga. You know, we're going to do whatever we can around Halloween to make people feel bad about the pumpkins and, you know, I mean, whatever it is, okay? That is still a key part of somebody's spiritual rebirthing process. They have to know they need Jesus. Agreed?
Yeah.
So just being nice to people ain't going to get it done. But what you'll see is that Jesus doesn't start there. There's some natural progression towards confrontation. And like I said, I've never had to confront somebody about their sin. They've always brought their sin to me to process it, and they're actually asking me to speak truth into their lives. Okay? So I think that's, and then eventually, then we have some transformation. They begin to walk with Jesus, and things begin to change. So a couple key notes, and I'm going to frame this more as how, like, if I was just to train your average church people to know what to do, I would give them some real simple concepts. Number one, just drop in. Okay, we're moving towards friend of sinners. This will be the biggie down here. What you want to be known for is friend of sinners. That would be the goal of that type of discipleship. But dropping in gets back to the time issue. I don't have time, whatever. When I go into churches, I usually try to prove to the parishioners that they are all at least part-time missionaries. So I have them get out a little piece of paper. So we'll do this right now. We'll just disciple each other, or at least mentally. How many of you have kids? Elementary, junior high, some high school? Those of you that have kids in sports, how many hours would you say you're on the same soccer field or in the same gym every week? Just being a parent with the same parents of the same kids, on average?
Two to three.
If you're junior high or high school, a little bit more, right? My two girls played ice hockey, so that was 5 to 6 nights a week and then games on weekends. So it tabbed out of 25 hours just on hockey. But most parents of junior high, high school would usually say 10 to 12 hours on that, okay? So I'll have them write that down. That is a mission field. You're the same family, same kids. So if you want to go sit on the corner of the bleachers and just be by yourself, you can do that. Or you can see everywhere you're at as a mission field. Where do you guys, well, how many hours a week do you go to the club and work out on average if you're into that stuff? Maybe 2 or 3, right? You got a favorite coffee shop or pub that you tend to frequent? Most people, a couple hours with some friends. Your street, where you live. Now, I'm a realist. I don't think every time you're in your house that you're on, you know, you're in the mission field. But for Cheryl and I, many of you know our story with my son's epilepsy. Ryan was born and day one started having 10 seizures, then it got to 20, 30 a day. So about every half hour, we had a grand mal seizure. So very little sleep at night. I was a house painter for both of our church plants. So, you know, 1 or 2 hours of sleep max a night for me. I was on night duty so Cheryl could deal with Ryan during the day. I would go to work about 5:30 and paint till about 2:30. And then a little nap on the way home, get home around 3 or 3:30, and then engage family, help out with Ryan, and then plant churches. So people go, well, how did you do that? And literally, it was Cheryl and I going, okay, what do we have to offer? And Cheryl said, we have to eat 21 meals a week. We never miss one. Could we give 6, 7, 8 of those meals away a week? So we made that commitment as a family. And it wasn't always together, but it'd be me grabbing 4 guys for a quick breakfast at 5 a.m. every other Tuesday morning. It'd be Cheryl with a couple ladies on Thursday afternoon, a happy hour at the house from just 5 to 6:30. Kids come over, they just hang out. Usually one night a week we would have groups of couples in, families, you know, 1, 2, 5, whatever. And then weekends, there's usually some party or something, just a Bronco game. Hey, why don't you guys just come over? So we started to realize with just a little bit of intentionality, we could give some meals away. We also bought a couple rocking chairs, put them out on the front porch, and that became the entrance to our neighborhood. We moved the barbecue from the backyard to the side yard, right inside the garage. So every time I'm throwing meat on the Barbie, it's WAP and the cavemen come out of the caves, right? So. But those were like when you go, okay, how did Adullam, the tangible kingdom story, happen? It was in the midst of all those seizures and working a full-time job, and the house just started to fill up because we actually saw everywhere we were at as a mission field. So if you're going to train your people to engage, I think you have to actually give them the specifics like that and go, I think each one of you are at least a 20-hour-a-week missionary if you see it like that. And if you can start to change that paradigm, people might, like literally when I tell that story, people will move their barbecues. It happened in our church. And they'll email and go, hey, it worked. I'll go, what worked? I moved the barbecue and dudes came over. I'm like, yep. So it can happen, but it has to be a retraining. So I say the key is to actually drop back into the human. So first step, I want to actually engage people see people come to Jesus, I go, who and where are you going to connect? And if they go, I have no idea, I usually go, what do you like to do? Sometimes they've never developed a life. We were training a mega church in Denver. All of their staff have PhDs. They had 60 staff. And when we were doing this simple engagement thing, they were like, so where do you connect? And we were like, well, what do you guys like to do? Well, they don't do anything other than God. So we actually ran a whole class with them called Get a Life. We had to actually teach them how to get a life. Okay? So I usually don't, you know, evangelism training for me isn't, hey, go to your neighbor and try to get a conversation. It's, what do you enjoy doing? And who can you do that with? And it's usually not who can you invite with you. It's who can you go find that's already doing what you like to do. So if you're into soccer, you join a soccer league. If you like softball, you get off the church softball. Like, get off the church stuff. Join the beer league team. If you have a passion for music, quit waiting around to get on the worship team. Go use your musical gift inside the civic realm. Whatever it is. If you love whiskey, get it. They have whiskey clubs all over. I mean, just, it's not hard. If you join people in what they're already doing, then you enjoy it. Again, if people are awkward socially, they've never invited people into their lives, it'll be a disaster if you try to get them to get people to join them. Right? So, for me, you know, I share the stories of yoga. That was my funny story. That was me. I'd never done it. I was getting really tired of Christian people in our church, and Cheryl said, go meet a new group of people. So I literally, cold call, I went, I'm going to go learn how to do the yoga thing. And that has led into all sorts of amazing stuff. Okay? Amazing stuff. Just because I went and joined a class. We just, as a family, just joined CrossFit about 3 months ago. I can barely walk. Ever. Seriously, I never hurt like this, ever. But, like, whole new community. And we actually got to know the managers really well. We have 700 people in our gym. And we just invited the managers over to see our place. We got a little 4-acre ranch, really cool spot. I said, if you guys ever want to like do like a staff dinner, we would love to host you, but one of you guys come over for wine just so we can show you what it looks like. And they thought we were going to charge them. We had to go, hey, no, this is like, we're part of your CrossFit family. Everything we offer you will be free. So now I'm actually going to go do some training. He's been losing staff because of some integrity issues. So I said, I love to do corporate training on to get your staff. And he's like, is that free? I'm like, yeah. So I'm offering service to them. I say, hey, come check out our house. They'll probably bring 30 of their trainers over in the next month for a nice dinner. So, but that all happens because we make the decision we're going to drop in. Okay, does that make sense? Mm-hmm. We just are not going to get evangelism to the rest of that world without training that. Okay, so once that happens, reputation begins to form. They might go, Hugh and Cheryl are kind of cool. They're not as religious as I thought. So they know I'm a pastor. So if you're trying to change assumptions, this is what I wrote in the book called Sacrilege. The best thing you can do to begin to change street cred is to be the least religious person anybody knows. I mean, that's what Jesus did there. He was not just unreligious, he was sacrilegious with everything that they held dear, from their temple worship to the, I mean, so Sundays have to become an important engagement time. If in the culture that you live in, it's a Sunday culture. Denver is a Sunday culture. So nobody wants to go to church on a Sunday because the Broncos are playing or something, okay? Some of you live in a Saturday culture, more of a collegiate culture. You got to be careful of the culture that you're in. But there's some things that Jesus did. He worked a job, so we make a big deal about work. That's also a mission field. But this friend of sinners thing, we'll camp on that because that's kind of what the brimstone was about. If you get people to do this, they will actually meet people that they've been hoping to meet. Mm-hmm. And then they're going to find out, oh, they actually aren't heterosexual, or they do smoke a lot of pot, or whatever it is. They don't discipline their kids the way I do. And so then what do you do there? And so I think you actually have to train this. And just some things that I think would be helpful if you're going to train non-judgmental cultural engagers, is teach them what I call context of sin. Okay? Context, we all always focus on the behavior of sin. You'll notice that Jesus doesn't focus on the behavior of sin. That's why he's able to eat with, like, Levi. Remember the Levi story? Okay, so you have, in the Levi story, you have one of the worst, like, dirty, rotten scoundrels. So the Bernie Madoffs of the day, the guys that ran Ponzi schemes and ripped people off of their entire life savings. So in that one story where Jesus eats with Levi, it says it was all the tax collectors in the city. So it wasn't just one dude. It was all the dirty, rotten scoundrels. And his own disciples wonder, well, why are you eating with them? Because eating means acceptance, at least in that moment, right? You would, in the Middle East culture, you would only eat who you are saying, I'm good with you right now. So how is Jesus, who's going to actually take the nail in the hand for their sins, how is he the most, I guess, or the least judgmental? Okay? So when you say that to Christian parishioners, you go, okay, Jesus was the most holy person that's ever lived, and yet the least judgmental. That's a head-scratcher, isn't it? Because he's the one taking the nail, right? Not us. So how is he able to do that? And I think it's because of the context of sin. So Jesus understands sin is something we can't fix on our own. And thus, he says, I did not come to condemn, but to save. Save means I'll go to the cross for you. That's the gospel. It's almost as if we've forgotten the gospel message, is you can't fix yourself. So I'll fix it for you. So in the meantime, because I'm going to macromanage sin at a big level, cross, he doesn't micromanage sin when he's sitting across the table with them. And that's a skill that you can teach people. If you know, people would ask, okay, can you get all these parties? Certainly, with your family, your daughters around, there would be people that would have one too many. And yes, there were many times where somebody would have one too many. They might even get obnoxious with their wife, be a little bit rude, loud, might even swear. So, how do you not? Well, because I realize that the behavior is not the problem. Okay, so I can overlook it. It's like when I was a linebacker in football, the coach said, you don't look at the linemen that are running at you to block you. Always keep your eyes on. So you keep sin in the peripheral. You don't keep sin at the focus. What you're looking at is somebody's heart, right? So until we have heart change, we're not going to have behavior change. And you don't change a person's heart by sticking a finger in there. It's human nature, right? Like, you know that's the way it is with you, right? If somebody really puts their finger in your chest, does that change you? Or does that puts the dukes up, right? How about your children? If you really go after your kids, do they really just roll over in humility and go, no, it's just like we see it as we raise our own children, that there's a way to gain somebody's heart, and there's a way to lose it. That's why the scriptures say to dads, don't embitter your children. Which means don't just beat the hell out of them with the law. Because that embitters them. That's specifically the context. Don't tell them, do this because I told you to, I'm your dad. If you keep doing that for 15 years, your kids will eventually go, I'm out. Okay? There's a way to win and woo somebody's heart. This is why when you see Jesus with the woman that's caught in adultery, here we have a real sin, right? Let's call it a real sin. And they bring her in front of Jesus. And so what does he do with the woman that, again, is going to put him up on the cross with that sin? He first removes accusers. You talk about, again, a mind blower and kind of a brimstone idea. We think that if we accuse people, that will draw them to Jesus. Well, Jesus removes accusers. Get out of the room. And then he says, woman, where are your accusers? She goes, they're gone. And then he says again, he doesn't even have to say it, it's extra credit. Woman, neither do I condemn you, right? And now he can speak truth. Woman, go and sin no more. Why is he able to finally speak truth? Because something has happened in her heart now, right? This man just saved my life. He has her at hello. It's the whole key to evangelism. You have to win somebody's heart. And heart, you win somebody's heart when they have had one too many, and you've had to break up a little fight between them and their wife, or you're at a poker party that they do, that they invite you to, and they go way over, and you got to actually drive them home and clean them up and tell the wife, you know what, I'll stay the night. Because she exposes that there's been abuse, and whenever he drinks too much, there's abuse. And when I've said, Kim, I'll just stay on the couch, don't worry. And I'll make sure Joe's all right tonight. I'll make sure you and the kids are safe. And then the next day, I take Joe out when he sobers up, and I go, hey, let's talk about last night. And then the confrontation of sins, it's right there, right? I don't need to confront it. Joe, Kim was, she was so afraid of you last night. And, Kim, I'm sorry. You don't have to apologize to me, Joe. It helped me to see what you guys are really dealing with. How long have you been struggling with this type of a pattern? You know, it seems like twice a year I have a big mess up like this. And it's just a few months down the road that Joe's going to come to faith, right? We're now finally in a Jesus with a woman and caught in adultery. Joe, are you sure you want to keep living like this? No. And Joe, I don't want to have to spend the night anymore at your house with your wife. Okay. Is this making, like, just had a, like, those are real stories for us. So I'm never, if people go, well, shouldn't you be afraid to engage culture? Like, what if your kids see that? That's exactly what I want my kids to see. I want them, and my girls, they knew that story.
Yeah.
And they remember Dad spent the night at Joe's house. And guess what my daughter's going to do with their friends? They go to parties to make sure stuff doesn't happen. Okay, so I just, to me, the cultural engagement, the way of Jesus, is the way you disciple your kids. Could bad things happen? Absolutely. I've shared of my youngest daughter getting assaulted at a party. Bad things can happen. It ruined her D1 hockey career. She jumped in the middle of a fight between a guy that was abusing her best friend. It cost her a lot. It cost her family a lot. But to see the growth in her and her to even go, Dad, don't, I mean, I was losing. I was going to try to kill this kid. And she said, you guys have taught us our whole lives to be peacemakers.
Okay.
So you see why I focus this on spiritual formation? If you can get your people to learn how to be holy but non-judgmental, they'll actually find themselves in the middle of people's real lives. And for Joe and Kim, guess who their go-to people are? It's us, right? Because we've been in their lives. We're their friends. That's. I really feel like this is, I don't know how we can talk about it more. We never talk about it. Art of neighboring, get the names of your neighbors. That's what Dave and Jay have. Just at least start there. They give you a little magnet to put up under. I mean, that's how bad we are. That we have to just, can you at least get their names? Gives you some idea why the church is imploding, why there's no denomination that's on the incline right now. Because we have literally not discipled people to be friends of sinners. So that's just an idea. Teach context of sin. The sin is not the problem. Teach self-righteousness. You got to help people see that they're self-righteous. Self-righteousness means that you don't think your sins are as bad as somebody else's sins. That's all it means. So how many of you remember, you old people, remember when Amy Grant, some of you don't even know who Amy Grant is. Remember when Amy wrote a crossover song? And we crucified her at a national level. And we almost threw Michael W. Smith under the bus because we knew they were friends. So everybody remembers that. So every generation has five or six biggies where we go, oh yeah, we judge them. Remember if somebody got divorced 40 years ago in the church? Done. When my mom and dad got divorced, done with the church. Okay? Now, that seems that we don't really call that anymore, right? By the way, there's two more scripture on divorce, remarriage, than there is on the gay orientation. But right now, we're pulling the gay thing out of the hat, and we're going, no, that sin, that's just too bad. Like, if we don't go after that one, it's going to take our whole society down. And yet we don't actually realize that we have a lot of heterosexual sexual issues going on that have already been destroying the church. Agreed?
Yeah, sure.
So that's all I'm saying, is that it's not that we don't, and I think you should vote your conscience. That's a right we have in America. But brimstone and flesh is about, it's kind of just assuming we're going to lose every vote at some point. And when we've lost every vote, does Jesus still have a way for his people to act in the world?
Yes.
And I go, so, you know, in brimstone, the very first page, I say if Jesus was the only baker in town, and Joe and Steve come in looking for a cake for their wedding, does he bake the cake? And I blogged that. We had about 5,000 responses in an hour. And I took several weeks and read those. Those were from the church, and it was split down the middle. People were not sure if Jesus would bake the cake. You can tell theologically, I would surmise that Jesus baked all of our cakes.
Sure.
Okay, but I didn't give an answer for that, but I would say, when you watch the woman that did not give the marriage license, and you find out that she has been married four times, that's what I'm saying, the world goes, like, just make us puke. Okay? And yet nobody really stands up and goes, actually, that's really bad that she doesn't see the self-righteousness in that. Okay? For the baker in Portland, Oregon that I know that said, I will not bake your cake, then the far left gay agenda is able to actually get them fined $200,000. And everybody around is going, yeah, but they at least stuck up for Jesus. I ask the question, does Jesus actually ask us to stick up for him? And I don't think he does. I think he's a big boy. He does ask us to represent him, though. And represent, so, okay, what would Jesus do if he was the baker in town? Would he make a big deal about the cake? And I threw out the story. I go, okay, well, imagine, just for sake of argument, if you're not trying to stand up for American political values, Christian political values, but if you actually want to change the heart of somebody, I said, is it possible there's a better place? So imagine Jesus, just for the sake of this argument, he bakes the cake. So you're at the wedding, and people are eating the cake, and you guys have been to weddings, so if the cake's good, you talk about it, right? Hey, this is like great cake. Like, God made it, super moist, awesome frosting. But somebody goes, well, who made the cake? Oh, it's the rabbi guy over there in the corner. Guy's setting up chairs. Yeah, apparently he's a really good friend of the bride and the bride and has been here all day setting up chairs. And yeah, I didn't think there'd be a rabbi in here. And I asked, I said, would Jesus get to have the conversations that all of us want to have? Yeah, I think that's the point of Jesus, why he eats with Levi. These guys are acting terrible. Way more destructive on the culture than a few people getting married that are gay, okay? So why is Jesus eating with them? Because over the dinner table, something's beginning to form. And we're eventually going to have some conversations where there might actually be a life change. And so I just think, you know, there's different ways to look at a lot of these cultural issues. Right now, American Christians think that you have to either condone or condemn. Those are your only two options. So if I go to a friend's wedding or to a bar mitzvah or some other religion, you know, it's my neighbor, right? They ask me to come to one of their Islamic ceremonies. You know, well, if I go, I'm condoning. And I don't want to condone, right? But I also don't want to condemn, you know, I mean, I do want to be loving. That's the dilemma most of us feel. And I think Jesus gives us a third option. I think he would actually say, I actually don't want you to do either. I want you to learn how to eat with people and be a friend. And I will do my work. The Holy Spirit is the one that convicts the world of sin, righteousness, and holiness, right? But it actually says, we can't. We don't have the ability to convict somebody. So when we try to, it's always going to come across like we're adversaries. So if you go, okay, Hugh, then, okay, is there a key to holy non-judgment? I go, yeah, I think it's what we say is called the hinge point. It's the great commandment where they say, Jesus, what's the greatest commandment of all? And he, remember after that, he said, by the way, all the law fits in Jungus. All the law and the prophets. Remember, the law is those do's and don'ts, and if you do the ones you're not supposed to, or you don't do the ones I tell you to, you're going to get in trouble with God, right? Well, once Jesus does his thing on the cross, remember, we're now given the ministry of reconciliation. And it says not of the what? It's not a ministry of the law. So our jobs are not to Ten Commandments the world, but it's now a ministry of the Spirit. We don't look at people from a worldly point of view or a fleshly point of view. It says we used to look at Jesus like that. But now we see that he's not just flesh, he's spirit. So when we look at people, we don't just see them through Genesis 3, the sinful, the cursed. We also see them first through Genesis 1, made in the image of God. That there's brokenness, but there's also beauty in every person. So if I have some Cheryl's horse trainers or two lesbian women, okay? And we may not jump up and be thrilled about their sexual choices, but they're some of the most amazing people that we've ever been around. And we see incredible beauty. Like, we just emotionally, we just love them. Okay? And they have found a place in our family. And they're now starting to talk about Jesus stuff with us. Okay, but all that is, I think, based on the hinge point. Love God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength. This is what everything hinges on now. It's not the law, it's the law of love. Okay? Which means no matter how they redefine marriage in America or what they legalize in your state, however bad the neighborhood is, you actually, Jesus would say, you're safe. Quit freaking out. If they take prayer out of schools, remember how we just all lost it over... Why didn't we just teach our kids to pray silently in schools? Why did we just freak out on everything? As Joshua said, as for me and my house, yeah, we'll serve the Lord. When it's speaking of evangelism in the New Testament, I think it's Timothy, it says, in your hearts revere Christ as Lord, and be ready to give a defense. So it's actually going, you don't just stand up and put out placards and go, I follow Jesus. It's almost like Jesus going, look, have a more humble posture. Your vertical commitment to me, that's between you and me, Jack. But then he says, but you also must love your neighbors as much as you love yourself, which means you are not, you cannot and you should not impose your vertical commitment to Jesus upon the horizontal plane of relationships around you. For these, your neighbors, all these people, you must learn to love them as much as your own family, and you cannot love what you judge. So, there's some tension there, right? So for me, when people go, okay, Hugh, but don't we have to answer for the truth? I actually used to think that. I really did. I memorized the New Testament. I'm a Bible guy. I love the Scripture. I think God breathed on them, and it's like the best stuff we have. And so I used to fight for truth. I was an apologetics major in seminary, so I was going to argue the whole world to Jesus. I now see that what we answer to Jesus for is the law of love. Did you love him? I didn't ask you to truth him. Now, Jesus came full of grace and truth. Not in order. He wasn't graceful so that he could speak truth. He was at every moment chock full of grace and truth. So people had this weird experience with him where they're like the best dude, but man, I sure want to hear what he has to say. We struggle with that full of grace, full of truth, right? So again, just like you don't have to condone or condemn, you don't have to pick grace or truth. You learn to grow in both those all the time. They will come. I really believe the culture wants truth. They want truth because their lives don't work. People ultimately, eventually will go, you know, I kind of would like my family to run a little bit more like the altars. And they will come looking for truth, but they're only going to receive truth from a friend, not an adversary. So, we got 5 minutes. Just any Q&A with this can be a bit of a mind blower, I know. I'm a recovering Pharisee, so this is not me hammering you guys. This is a lifelong journey of going, well, why is it working in our house? Remember at the end of, I'll just leave with this and I'll take questions. Remember where that scripture, I think it's Matthew 11, And Jesus came eating and drinking, and so we called him a drunk and a glutton, mm-hmm. a friend of tax collectors and sinners. Remember what it says at the end of that scripture? I don't ever remember. It says, Jesus says, and wisdom is proved right by her offspring. In other words, you'll know what the right way to go is by the results that you see. So if you look at the evangelical church the last 40 years, you look at our basket of conversion growth, it's not a really exciting looking basket. Jesus might be going, okay, I know it's hard. I know, look, if your gay neighbors invite you to their wedding in the backyard, I know it's going to cause, but would you consider my way? If you go, proximity to sinners doesn't mean you're condoning, just go. Going to a gay wedding doesn't mean that you're celebrating their wedding. It just means that you love them and you're with them. That's why Emmanuel, God not against us, not God doing something to us, it's God with us in all of our crowd, all of our sin, baking our cake for us while we were yet sinners. Christ died for us. Also, while we were yet sinners, that means Christ lived in the neighborhood as our friend. Okay, so just some thoughts, questions. Questions you think your people are going to have?
There's this actual situation in our church right now where we had a young girl that came to Christ, and she, in our college ministry, and she's going to get married to this non-Christian. So, and the wedding's going to probably be half Christians, half non-Christians. And there's sort of a little debate within our church whether or not the bridesmaids that she has that are Christians, whether they should be in the wedding. Because otherwise they're by them standing up, they're saying, we agree that you should be unequally yoked.
It's actually an amazing thing when you think about it. When I grew up, I was the only pastor in, I think, Portland that would marry non-believers, two non-believers. And that was the formation of our church. I got so much time with these great young couples that many of them came to faith. Another pastor, well, I can't. If I do, I'll get in trouble with my church. It's the same thing. It's all these sort of made up. I mean, I used to have all sorts of non-Christians on our worship team. And people would go, you can't do that. And I go, read the entire four Gospels. Jesus is including 12 knuckleheads that don't know that he's the Messiah in all sorts of ministry, right? I mean, I thought the point of this whole witness thing was to get people near to Jesus. In any way we can, get them in the room. So the people in our church that came to faith were the people that played the bass that we got out of the club scenes. And they came to faith because they saw the words after about 12 months and went, oh, I think I believe that now.
Yes.
My first children's, not director, my first children's teacher in our church in Portland was our non-believing neighbor, Lori. She asked, when we told her we're going to try and start a church, she goes, oh, how can I help? Well, all sorts of people are freaking out about, well, you can't have a non, and it's like, well, what if she doesn't know the Bible? Well, she already told me she doesn't know the Bible. She actually asked me to teach her Bible stories. And then she would craft them into a lesson. And then she came to faith about 8 months in. And she said, when we baptized her, it's because you guys included me, and I started to see that the kids believed the stories, and I started to believe. Mm-hmm. We just said, I mean, if you look at Franklin Graham, Samaritan's Purse, you can't even serve in their ministry to the poor unless you sign a document about, what does that have to do with working with the poor? It's just like, it's almost like we create so many lines where we say, you can't get close to Jesus. And I just think we have to stop that. Communion table used to, I mean, we've used communion as a line in the sand, right? Or Jesus just says, hey, whenever you guys get together and eat a meal, would you remember, like, we turn just some of the most beautiful things Jesus does into institutions. So institutions of sacraments of marriage, communion, those are some of our weirdest lines. And Youth for Christ, I was an evangelistic ministry. We were taught to use the communion table as the evangelistic invite. Okay, so it's just, it's whatever your paradigm is, but realize there are different paradigms. And I would just say, whenever you create your own man-made lines where you keep somebody from Jesus, you're doing exactly what they did in the temple. They had 9 rings of holiness, court of women, court of Gentiles, and Jesus basically bulldozed all of the lines and just went, would you just get people to me? So why would you want to not, I mean,
mean, why would you not want some non-Christian women to be in the middle of a wedding ceremony where they can hear?
No, I mean the Christian. Somebody's telling the Christian girls that are in the wedding, don't stand for them. If you're in the wedding, you're basically condoning her being unable to yield to this man. So there's a debate whether do they have to step out of the wedding or.
I'm saying because we misunderstood marriage from what's standing up. We have our own wording. Back in the day, does anybody have any problem with this man and woman being married? And I guess, you know, 80 years ago, maybe somebody would stand up. But I don't know anybody that's done that recently, right? So being at the wedding, half the people at the wedding don't even know the other person. I mean, so you just have to realize what we're dealing with there. We, again, are making up our own lines in the sand. I think even, you know, the reason why I use the gay dilemma is because if you can help navigate the gay dilemma, you can navigate almost all the other dilemmas really easily. So if people say, Hugh, will you do a gay wedding? I actually, right now, say, no, I don't. I've been asked 30 times. And every time I say, Joe, you know I love you, right? You know I've never judged you. You know I don't understand your orientation, but you know, like, you're one of my best friends. But I say, where I'm at right now in my processing of my role in sanctioning marriage, I just feel uncomfortable. It would do something weird in my conscience. And I just say, will you respect where I'm at right now? And every time they go, totally. Hey, but I'm not, you see, I'm not making necessarily a judgment. I'm also, you can still stand for your conscience. Mm-hmm. In fact, in the body of Christ, in almost every church now, you will have half the people that will go to a friend's wedding that's gay because they're just trying to stay a friend, right? And you'd have some that wouldn't. And you'll have some people that would bake the cake and go, no biggie, I'll bake the cake. And you'll have some that will just, I just can't. Well, the scriptures actually say we're not to force our brothers and sisters to change their conscience. Doesn't mean we don't say, hey, consider looking at this from the other angle. And that's why Paul later on, he says, begin to fight for the unity of the Spirit. When you have to tell people to fight for the unity of the Spirit, it's because they have completely opposing worldviews. So when Gentile and Jew started to come together, totally different. So Paul's going, look, fight for the unity. I think it will be okay someday in your churches where you will have people will come down on different sides of the gay dilemmas or whatever it is. But I do think it's worth challenging some of the ways that we think. I would just throw this at you at a church level. And just mystiologically, culturally, a lot of churches feel like they have to decide because parishioners are going, Pastor, we need you to come down on this issue. Where do we stand? And I would encourage you not to make public stances on websites, whatever it is. I think it's okay to have internal doc statements. But whenever you make a stance, if they say, Hugh, why wouldn't you make a stance on homosexual sin? I'd say because every homosexual person I know has had a very unique, different story. And some of them, I believe, are born that way, and some of them, I think, choose it. Each person is different. I would never make a stance, generally speaking, because every person has their own context. And Jesus dealt with every person differently. That's why in this church we don't make stances. We stand with everybody to try to help them come closer to Jesus, and we let Jesus begin to straighten it out as much as he can. Okay? And you will begin to have that. I grew up in a paradigm where you only chose to be gay. So these are rebellious sinners that chose to be gay. I now have too many friends whose children are showing extreme gay tendencies at the age of 4 or 5, and the parents are coming going, I think Steve is gay. What do I do? So the battle that we'll start to see the next 10 years will be a battle over whether or not orientation is a sin, or how do we deal with orientation versus overt rebellious type of sin. And that will be, that's going to be a toughie.
Yeah, so we're church planters in San Francisco, and when I talk with people about this and say, you know, if I get gay friends, they're like, oh, this is born that way. I'm like, hey, guess what? So was I.
All born,
you're born
sin,
gay?
Right?
Well, no, I was born in sin. I love to be right. From the day, in my youngest memory, I loved to be right. And I would win any argument regardless of the cost. I never remember a time when I wasn't that right. And I had to learn that acting on that impulse that I was born with was sinful.
so I have a friend that has a 15-year-old daughter that they just found her journal. For 3 years, she was struggling with that. Yeah. Every scripture, every argument, her prayer is begging God to take this from her. And he's pastor of the Church of Texas, very large. They're very well known. And he's now going, but the simplistic answers of just don't have sex. Mm. If we just say it like that,
yep.
You got to be careful with the posture of that, because that actually is some of the most brutal. If somebody told you, just don't have sex. In other words, just don't have intimate relationship in a way that's most meaningful to you. Just realize that even when you say that, if anything should make you weak, it would be something like that.
Yeah.
So if you don't have compassion upon that story, the church probably, in my estimation, even to say, look, based on what we read in the scripture, this is where I personally have come down, but at the same time, we should be weeping tears, that this would be the most difficult life to live. And so the fact that the gay community feels no compassion from the evangelical church, says for sure our posture has been wrong. Good chance our theology also has been a little bit lax. Okay? Our theology of judgment has been way off base. So I would just say in this, I think really the next 10 years, you're going to really see the evangelical church almost be split on these issues. I would pray that you would have the talks inside your church about what it would look like for us not to split. I have a friend that's a pastor of a church in Seattle that's very well known. He knows the first fully affirming gay megachurch. And I put his email in the Brimstone book to our team, because when he came out, we all encouraged him to really think through that. We didn't think he thought through it well. We pushed back against him as an accountability group, and he did it anyway. But then he wrote a letter to us saying, guys, I know you don't agree with me, but I do still sense that you love me. You know I love Jesus. I'm doing what I feel like I can in my context. He's thinking this theologically. And so I hope for the day that even inside the church, that we can actually have some bearing beliefs on this thing. I think it will somehow witness. I actually could be wrong on that one. But again, we're not just a people of theology. We're also a people of missiology. And Jesus gives us unbelievable theology, right? He also gives us some missiology. And Jesus was traveling in some times, just like ours. He still influenced hearts. So I would always try and encourage you, you're probably not going to change a person through your theology. You made them through immeasurable grace and walking with them. I have friends that have come to faith in Jesus and they did not come out of lifestyle. I know they love Jesus, they're struggling through it, but they're not willing to go, it's not going to have sex their whole life. Somehow there must, and I stand by it. I don't say that I agree or disagree, but I go, I'm not leaving you as a friend. Right, so, tough stuff. I encourage you to dive in with your people, but I went way over. If you disagree with anything I said, you could be right. So.